Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Chelsea Echo podcast. It is myself, Louis Beneventi.
Daniel Childs.
And we are here to give you everything you need to know about, as Dan has aptly named it before the record. What did you call this game, Dan?
It's the Clear Lake Derby, the El Clear Lake-o.
El Clear Lake-o. It is the El Clear Lake-o. It is Chelsea Football Club, a.k.a. Benedict Barley versus Graham Potter. And Kyle McCauley, who they've just taken from us.
And Emerson Palmieri.
Emerson Palmieri. Kurt Zouma's not there anymore, is he? He's gone.
I don't think so.
Oh, God. Sad times. No Kurt. Who's going to kick the cats? But, guys, this is obviously a big, big game for Chelsea on deadline day as well. So before we do get into it, please do make sure that after the game, if you are listening to this, that you tune in to Final Score with The Score, as we're going to be obviously talking all about the fixture for the first hour. It's going to be an extended special because in the second hour, we're going to be talking all things transfers, because apparently, according to Enzo Maresca, Chelsea are going to be very, very busy in the market. And we probably should just jump straight into that before we play our usual game, Dan, and talk about the fact that apparently Chelsea are going to be very, very busy. It has been a rather underwhelming window until the last couple of days, has it not?
Has it changed? Have I missed something before we started recording this?
Well, Cesare Casade has actually moved to Torino now. That's done.
Okay.
I put that down to Italian bureaucracy and the fact that we have two very inept sporting directors who take far too long to get anything done. So we've got that. Obviously, Matthias Tell was an apparent target for Chelsea Football Club. He rejected Tottenham Hotspur, which is quite funny. I enjoyed that, as I'm sure a lot of people did. But he is apparently favouring a move to Manchester United. Alejandro Garnacho, that has gone quiet as well. Nothing really happening there. But Enzo Maresca has said that in the market, Chelsea will be busy, and there are rumours flying around about centre-backs, about midfielders, about strikers, not about goalkeepers, but we're going to talk about goalkeepers later because that's a fairly obvious subject, which Dan and I will touch on in the Echo 11, because there is a full thing to actually talk about there rather than our usual move through it. But a name that has been thrown into the hat over the past 24 hours is Evan Ferguson. Yet again, another Brighton guy, someone who has scored 7 goals since 22-23, but apparently is the best up-and-coming striker in the world, according to some. I am, again, massively underwhelmed with Chelsea's movement in the market. And just to add, by the way, to Evan Ferguson, apparently West Ham are also in for him as well. So El Clilico has a lot riding on it because both teams need a striker.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what to think of Evan Ferguson, and it, in some ways it kind of shows you how quickly and how flimsy reputation is in the transfer market, because of course the season you referenced, 22-23, he of course was in a very different time and he wasn't suffering or trying to recover from a long-term injury, and there were talks that he could be the next £100 million player, you know, being linked away, and obviously that has quickly been derailed. He's not a terrible option, in truth, if we're being honest. At least he's someone that's played Premier League football and I think at least would give you some form of a rotational option. However, I just don't know what to think of him, to be honest.
Is he somebody that is going to add value? Like, honestly, like, serious? Like, this is not me saying that he's a bad player, by the way, because I think there's evidence to prove that he is a good player. But like you said, he's had a long-term injury. He's not someone who's been very reliable for Brighton. His career has been on from a financial perspective, a downwards trajectory ever since he was touted to be the next £100 million player. Is he somebody who actually adds value to this team, or is he just a body through the door? This is where it's important, because if it is just a body through the door, that's a waste of time, because you could be looking at another João Félix situation, who, by the way, is going out on loan again to somebody else. Like, honestly, his career has just bounced around. It was a terrible move for him to come to Chelsea. We don't know what's going on with Christopher Nkunku either. You know, there's so many things here in play where signing Evan Ferguson, I think, is just very much we looked at him 2 years ago, let's give it another go, rather than actually looking at someone who adds value to push Chelsea into the Champions League places for a guaranteed top four spot.
Well, if we talk about striker options and we just look at Evan Ferguson, he is an upgrade on Mark Guiu. I think. I think that's a fair argument to make. Is he a substantial upgrade to a point where, as you say, his involvement between now and the end of the season is going to make a substantial difference? I can't say that for certain. I don't know. Here's a counter argument, right? Because I know a lot of us have been very negative, and I think justifiably so, about the handling of this window, the handling of the last transfer window. But a counter argument I have seen from people I respect sort of going, actually, this has not been a bad window. And the reason they give is, and I think you'll agree with the reason actually, is not because, oh, the squad building's been amazing. It's that because we haven't signed anyone, we haven't added more clutter and mistake onto mistakes that have already been made. Which I've said in my show yesterday on my channel.
It's such a positive spin on the load of
bombs. I know, but it's like, isn't it the most damning indictment of like Chelsea currently that fans are, I'm not saying positive in the way of like cheery about it, but like they view it as a better window because we don't trust the decision makers to do anything in the window. So
I want names. I need to know who said this.
Well, even like I know Ollie Glanville, a guy I respect, has sort of alluded to it. I do have sympathy for that argument, right? Primarily because, as we've talked about before, if you don't trust the decision makers, then why would you trust them to get it right? I think that's the starting point of that argument. It's not that everything's perfect and if we don't do anything, everything's going to be amazing. It's just, these are the people that got us to this point in the first place. How do you expect them to get us out of this problem? But I think at the end of the day, it's just a damning indictment on squad building in general that you're kind of so fearful they're going to get it wrong that you just go, don't do anything. Because between now and deadline day, like let's say between now and deadline day, Chelsea signed someone and it's Garnacho. I don't think that's a good move. I don't think that moves the needle any point. I don't even think Evan Ferguson moves the needle. And I've kind of reached a point now of a little bit more zen about it, of like, it'd be hypocritical of me to sit here on Monday if we've signed one player and suddenly go, oh wow, that's like the solution, unless that player is another Cole Palmer, which is very, very unlikely. Because if a system is fundamentally broken and you don't trust the decision makers, one win, one signing shouldn't change that vibe. It shouldn't change the overall concern. So that's where I am at this point. Like I unless they pull something absolutely miraculous that one player completely turns around our season, I don't think that's going to be relevant. And even if they did sign someone that serves as a bit of an uptick, we were here at the start of the season when we started the season better than expected. But then by the next transfer window, I think you reach the same problem again. So that's just a counter-argument. It's not, the counter-argument isn't, and if anyone is counter-arguing like seriously that why are people complaining, the squad's amazing, then yeah, I think that's nonsensical.
It is quite frankly an absolute farce if anybody thinks that way. I get what you're saying. I see the counter argument, and it makes a lot of sense. But that just is, like you said, it's a damning indictment on where Chelsea are right now. You look at Win Stanley. You look at Stewart. Two people have asked for four windows. They then move the goalposts again to suit themselves. They've not actually had a report for performance review yet, I don't think. I think, obviously, when Pochettino was having his performance review last season, they didn't get one.
Well, the concerning thing is, I assume you saw this, Matt Law was on the London is Blue pod, and one of the quotes that's gone quite viral is him saying, effectively, that if Chelsea fails to get Champions League football, it's going to be Enzo Maresca who's in more trouble than they are. Which, I'm not against that because I believe that Enzo Maresca is faultless in this situation. Again, who is the... Everyone kind of jumping to defend Enzo Maresca at the moment. Like, who was the one who appointed him in the first place? That's a point I would make. It's not like Enzo Maresca just randomly fell out the sky and had nothing to do with no one at the club currently. Like, in some ways...
He fell out the sky and went, I'm good on the ball. We are good off the ball. That's all it was. Like, oh my God, I love this guy. Where did he come from?
So I think there's a little bit of revisionism and kind of disingenuous kind of takes there, because I think in some ways, like not to the same extent, but I think Maresca, like Sanchez, is a symptom of a bigger problem. I'm not saying that those two problems are the same, but I just think it says so much, right? That like that's where we are. Like Chelsea could fail, and this is, you know, you can't question what Matt Law says, like, because his track record is immaculate, right? He has very good knowledge on the inner workings of Chelsea. And I think what it tells you is, and just from a fan point of view, whatever it like could lead to or doesn't lead to, it should concern you as a fan that that is the mentality at the top, and how that is, I don't know, symbolically or kind of, I'm trying to think of the right word here, like just psychologically, how that bleeds down to the coach and into the players about a lack of accountability across the club. If the people with that power have no accountability to fail, when they fail, they'll just be given more money and more time to fail again. If you're a player, maybe that seeps through as well. Not to everyone, but that it is a damn,
does.
You know. And again, it goes back to my sort of broader conversation. We can discuss transfers all we want, but I don't think that changes much at all if this is the mentality at the top of the club.
This is the problem. I mean, I took the London's Blue tweet, quoted it yesterday, and I said that it's right now the club is a joke and it only hinders itself the longer that Win Stanley and Stewart are in charge. All the work that was done by Bates and Roman's tenures to make Chelsea a recognised force has been ripped apart in a click of the fingers and is now a complete farce mentality. I think the best way you said it, you know, you talk about it seeps down to the players. If there is no accountability, there is no results. The constant need for them to shift the goalposts to try and prove a point, say, well, we can do this, we are good at this, we are doing that. It goes back to what I've been saying for the past couple of weeks. I have no doubt in the roles that they had at their previous clubs, they were fantastic. And I think that serves as an example of the level they are. You look at Graham Potter, who obviously we're going to talk about later, obviously, with the West Ham game. I have no doubt he's going to do very, very well at West Ham. Do you know why he's going to do well at West Ham? Because they don't have the same expectations of Chelsea Football Club. The fact remains that between Ken Bates and Roman Abramovich, Chelsea became a superpower in football. They were considered a force for anyone to reckon with, European and globally. It was a fact that you'd look at the Chelsea and say, this is a club. This is where you want to be. Look at the names attached. Look at the people involved. Look at the trophies they're winning. This is a serious place to be. Now it's a case of, we've had four transfer windows, but we actually didn't mean these four transfer windows. We need another four. We want to get Champions League. And we said that in the last programme of the season, last season, that was what we expect. But we don't expect it yet. So well, hang on. Like, you guys are the ones that are setting this example. You're setting the barometers for these results. This is your job, and you are the ones that are ruining it for everybody else. 30 years of work to make Chelsea a recognised superpower has been ripped up right now because they want to say, well, we want to do it our way. If you wanted to do that, I'm not going to lie, right? Clear Lake Capital and Todd Boehly should not have bought Chelsea Football Club. Go and buy another Wrexham. Go start your own thing down there. Because you can do that. What you have, and but even then, by the way, I'm not saying completely rip up the culture, completely rip up everything, because that is a big mistake. Because you don't do that. If you want a good example, as much as I love to discredit American ownership in football, right? Look at what's being done at Wrexham. Sure, to people in the lower divisions, it's a case of going, well, you know, they're ruining it, they're bringing better players in, it's too much money, it's completely changing the pyramid. I completely understand that logic. But these are guys that have pumped money into a community, into a club, bought into the culture, added their own elements of things, but they haven't completely torn it apart. Chelsea has been torn apart from the inside out, from the academy all the way up. Neil Barth is a great example, someone who's now no longer at Chelsea, you know, someone who was credited with bringing through amazing names, players which have gone on to have great careers, not just at Chelsea Football Club, by the way, all over European football, winning multiple trophies, being stellar examples to any club they go into, whether it's in the Premier League, the Championship, or abroad, or wherever they go. They're always credited as coming from Chelsea because of the level of quality that came out of that academy. That is now not there because it's just PSR and it's just for throwing people in. I want to go to Brazil and outsource and get all of this sort of stuff. When we actually have players of quality, which could already fit the bill in other places as well, which were finally starting to filter through alongside credible signings, which I think is what a lot of people have always wanted, and that is how you run a football club. Sure, granted, there were flaws in how we were run under Roman Abramovich, right? There was a case of, if there was a financial hole, he would fill the gap, right? I appreciate that. So that's something which we were very lucky to have, if we're being very honest.
Mm.
And Chelsea did need to become a going concern, or a more often become a going concern. But this was not the way to do it. You look at how the women's team's doing, right? They were kind of left to their own devices, doing their own things, and lo and behold, look what's happened. They've been credible. They've been fantastic. The football's been great. Not, when they've been in a strong position, they've been reinforced by even stronger players as well in this transfer window. You know, a transfer record just been dropped on a player to come to the women's side. But
Keira
no,
Walsh
the men's
too,
side doesn't need that.
You know,
Keira Walsh as well.
From Barcelona, who's, you know, England international. It's funny enough, I submitted my fanzine piece yesterday, and this was kind of, I originally was going to go in one direction, and then I was writing it, and I thought, actually, let's contrast this with the Chelsea women, right? Because it is just so staggering when you look at two teams under one name that are supposed to be under one umbrella, and how different, how stark the levels of competence and ambition and kind of just the vibe around everything between the men and women is so stark. And, you know, Chelsea women have been the best Chelsea team for about, I want to say, like 5-6 years. I know in that time Chelsea have won a Champions League on the men's side, but in terms of domestic quality, in terms of coaching quality, in terms of squad management and transfer hit rate, the women's team has been immense. And it says so much that one of the greatest leaders we've ever seen at Chelsea across any team leaves in the summer, and there's concern of, well, how can you fill that massive hole that's been left by Emma Hayes? And not only do you bring in an elite coach, but it's quite clear the foundations there were very, very strong and built by Emma Hayes that have lasted and only been built upon. So I think we should move on to West Ham, because I feel like we go, you know, round in circles, but it is something notable, and it's not, it does get a bit tiring even for me, because I think that there are things that I kind of, when I say justified, it sounds like I wanted it to get to this stage, which I didn't, obviously, because both of us get pissed off when Chelsea don't win. It annoys me. I watch along for the City game, and I was absolutely fuming for that second goal.
Oh, God, don't get me started on that.
But it is, you know, as fans, like, and as someone who, you know, like you who talks about Chelsea a lot on a podcast, like, we give our opinions and we're honest when we're wrong. But then also, if we're proven right about things, I think it's beneficial to be honest. And also, just the general vibe around Chelsea a month ago or 2 months ago was obviously positive, and that on this podcast that was reflected. Now, 2 months later, the vibe is very different, and that's what's being reflected. And we hope it can go back to a different way, but like, I've always constantly said, I just don't think denying reality helps anyone, because, you know, maybe the shock, and maybe the shock people are feeling over the past few weeks, that they're coming around to maybe the way we felt all along during the summer. Maybe it's harder for some people to take, because it's like, they wanted to believe during the summer. They wanted to believe and be ambitious and be optimistic about their club and believe, you know, everything was going in this great holistic direction. Everyone wants to believe their club are doing the right thing. Everyone wants to believe that there is hope, you know, further down the line. I absolutely understand that tendency for any football fan, right? No matter what level of club they support. But I feel like a lot of people are now realizing, and hopefully realizing, that transfers are not just the easy out. Or one transfer is not just going to be the easy out for everything. There's core fundamental issues.
Yeah, it's a dopamine rush. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And we need to recognise that we're in a position where Chelsea are not, on the men's side at least, because again, we've credited the women's side, on the men's side are not performing to the standards that people expect. And I'm not saying, I'm never going to say Chelsea need to deserve to be somewhere, but Chelsea have a track record and a credibility which they said they wanted to uphold. So realistically, the club need to start behaving like it. But we will move on to West Ham and we will play our game, which we still don't have a name for or a working title. It's still
Rewind Selector.
I think
we were going to call it Rewind Selector, wasn't it?
That's it. And it's got the other A. That's it. It's like, minimiser, Rewind Selector. So we're going to play the game. Is this week, Dan? Is it me or is it you?
I feel like I've done a lot of these recently. Like I've had to guess a lot of these recently. So I'm going to pick a random Chelsea West Ham game at the Bridge.
Okay.
From quite a few years ago. I'm trying to pick one that isn't obvious because there's been a lot of notable ones. But yeah. I feel like a lot of those teams, the Conte, you know, when Costa scored late on, JT celebrating in front of the away end was hilarious. But I feel like that team was, you'd probably be able to get most of that team.
Yeah. I was because in my head, I've got either one or two. I haven't looked them up yet because I was just thinking it was either going to be when Gianfranco Zola was the manager of West Ham, or I was going to go for the Samuele Aladici 0-0 draw. Which I was actually ironically talking about with a West Ham fan a couple of days ago, which we enjoyed discussing to a certain
extent.
Well,
this was on the 20. This is the famous 0-0 game where Aladici himself was saying, the quote,
he can't take it.
He can't take it. Let's go with the West Ham team, if I can get it up here, because this was one of those games in that season that, man, it felt, this is why kind of Chelsea didn't win the league that year. And yeah. Why we eventually needed Diego Costa to come in. Here we go.
This is 2013-14, isn't it? Right.
Yes. End of January. Okay. So just, you know, how many years ago would that have been now? 9 years ago now. Just over 9 years ago. Right. So you're gonna go through the West Ham team.
Well, I don't want to go back to front because I confused myself, but I know who played up front that day because I've got that locked in, and I'm guessing. Sam Allardyce, it was a 4-4-2, right?
No, actually. Well, the way it's written down here is a 4-5-1.
Okay, right. So, 2013-14. Was it Fabianski in goal?
No. Fabianski, Adrian. I think, was still... Yeah, Adrian. Fabianski was still at Arsenal at this point.
Okay. Adrian was in goal.
Defenders.
Cresswell?
No.
Oh, balls. I'm in trouble already. Centre-halves. Was it Winston Reid, James Collins?
You got James Collins. There's no Winston Reid. I feel like there's no way you're getting the other centre-back, and I'm not even sure you're going to get the left-back.
Can I have clues?
The other defenders, one of them has kind of been more synonymous, actually, for quite a few years with Crystal Palace, and the left-back is from the Ivory Coast. I don't even know who this is, so...
Checo Kiyate?
No. I feel like you should get... and there's another defender who's from Ireland. But you should get...
Oh, no! I know the centre-back. I know who it is. I can see his face. Oh, James Tompkins.
Yeah, there we go.
Come on! right-back, you said, was Irish, right?
No, this was the other centre-back. Number 17. He got a yellow card on this game.
I thought James Collins was a centre-back. I thought it was James Collins and
James Collins,
Tompkins.
Well, I think Tompkins was probably playing right-back.
Okay.
And you had James Collins, and then you had a left-back and another centre-back.
Left-backs from the Ivory Coast. Left-backs from the Ivory Coast. Left-backs from the Ivory Coast.
I don't even think some West Ham fans would get this, to be honest, mate.
Okay, no, the other centre-back, I am not sure.
From
Irish centre-back played for West Ham. I'll never give you another clue. I always give you one clue and I'll have to leave it. So I'll have to do that then because I don't know who that is. We'll go into the midfield. Mohamed Diame?
Yes.
Yes. Mo Diame.
God, there are some classic... Yeah, there are some great Barclaysman names in here. So you got two of the... You got three more. I expect you to get all these three. These are Barclaysman era names.
Noble Diame and the other central midfielder. Right. European or African?
The rest of the midfielders are all English.
Mark Noble, Mo Diame, left mid. I'm trying to figure out who that could be. Stuart Downing.
Yeah, there we go.
Right mid, English, played for West Ham.
He was the captain on this night.
Oh, that's thrown me then. Oh, wow. Oh, that's really thrown me, because I thought Mark Noble would have been the captain.
You should get this. You will know this name and you'll be kicking yourself. He may not exactly like be known more for West Ham.
Can you give me another club he played for? If it's too obvious, I don't give me another clue.
It's how good your I feel like your Barclaysman knowledge is pretty good. If I give you the club, I can give you the club of the other midfielder that I think is probably to the other midfielder who's English, played for Portsmouth before playing for West Ham.
Played for Portsmouth before playing for West Ham. Oh my god! And he was in that Portsmouth team with Harry Redknapp, right?
Definitely Redknapp era.
No, I'm going to kick myself. I don't know. Central midfield, played for Portsmouth, played for West Ham. I know Andy Carroll played up front. That's one thing I do know.
Yeah.
So you've got Andy Carroll up front. I'm now missing five players. Oh my god, I've had a mare. I'm out, mate. I don't know.
You will kick yourself for these two. So let's go from the ones you didn't get. So you got Adrian, you got James Tompkins, you got James Collins. Joseph O'Brien was the other centre-back.
Nah, I was never going to get that.
And you were never going to get Guy Demel, who was number 20, the left-back. On this on the Premier League site, he doesn't even have a profile picture. That's how obscure this player is.
Okay.
But I have to say, you're going to kick yourself for these two midfielders. I think especially for one of them. The one who played for Portsmouth was Matthew Taylor.
Yeah, that's bad.
And
that's
bad. This is the egregious one.
Wait, hang on. Is it Etherington?
No.
Okay, that's fine. Okay,
the egregious one, captain that night, Kevin Nolan.
Oh, Louis! Oh, that is awful! Oh, I'm so angry at myself.
On the bench that
Kevin
night...
Kevin Nolan!
Oh, we're talking about some proper Prem players here. Goalkeeper on the bench for West Ham, Yuri Askalainen. George McCartney, God. Matthew Jarvis. Ravel Morrison was on the bench that night. Carton Cole was on the bench that night.
Yeah, he came on, I remember that.
As we always do, let's. Can you get the Chelsea team?
I feel like that'd be quite easy. Petacek.
Yep.
Branner, JT, Cahill.
Yep.
Asby.
Yep.
Actually, midfield gets interesting. Frank?
No Frank in this starting 11.
Ramirez?
Yep.
Mikel?
Yep.
I want to say it was midweek, wasn't it? Yeah, Mikel, I started midweek. Oscar?
Yep.
Hazard? Willian.
Yep.
And I want to say Samueletto.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh!
The bench that night was Mark Schwarzer, Ashley Cole, David Luiz, Frank Lampard, Nemanja Matic, Andre Schürrle, and Demba Ba.
See, I was torn between that Bar and Eto. I still remember the first time I ever saw Demba Ba. He was playing for West Ham. I think he was under Zola. He came on. I think him and Dean Ashton played up front.
Jesus, that was quite far back, wasn't it? Like Zola was like 2009, wasn't he?
Yeah, 2009, 2010. I was at that game. I remember looking down, seeing him. But yeah, I'm actually really disappointed I didn't get Kevin Nolan. That is really not good. But having said all of that, we probably should move on now to the only part of the show that does have a jingle. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Stat Shaggers.
The Chelsea Echo presents Stat Shaggers.
Chelsea playing West Ham, desperate for a win. Oh, and they're managed by Graham Potter. What could possibly go wrong? Horrible feeling about this game, I have to say, but there we go. The two teams have now played 103 times in total. Chelsea have been on the winning side 56 times and lost 44, drawn 33 of those games. And of course, the Blues now are firmly locked into battle with Newcastle, Manchester City and Bournemouth for Champions League football. And every single point is key to secure that. Hopefully that will be top five, not top four, thanks to the work of, well, everyone in Europe, but particularly Man City, to scrape through. Everyone else had already done their job. Anyway, I digress. The Hammers are not exactly flying high. In fact, far from it. They are 14th in the league, and they've lost three of their last five Premier League matches. That included a thumping 5-0 loss to Liverpool, and then a 4-1 demolition at the hands of Manchester City, before Potter, of course, came in. And he's earned 4 points from his first three games. Fairly respectable, which I think is really all he will care about doing. A 3-2 win over Fulham was a solid start, backed up by a disappointing 2-0 loss at home to Crystal Palace before a credible 1-1 draw away at Aston Villa. Potter will want to solely stabilise and achieve a mid-table finish, which he seems destined to do realistically. This match against Chelsea,
Well, it will have added meaning for him, of course, after such a disappointing tenure at Stamford Bridge. And, of course, his time at West Ham now is not just a good job, but it's also repairing his very damaged reputation after that job. The Hammers, well, they've struggled at both ends of the pitch, to be quite frank. They scored only 28 goals. Only five teams have scored fewer than that, while they have conceded 44, which is more than every other team in the league other than the bottom four. So they are there for the taking. And in theory, this should be a pretty comfortable win for Chelsea. The Hammers, they've won three of the last 10 against Chelsea, all of which were at their place. So whilst we do seem to have had our difficulties against West Ham, they've always been on the road. And they, West Ham, have seemingly found it relatively difficult at Stamford Bridge. In the last 10, as I said, West Ham have won three, Chelsea have won six, and there has been one draw. All four home fixtures for the Blues have been won, including a 5-0 win last time out when Nicholas Jackson scored a second half brace. He then, well, he picked up where he left off and repeated the feat last time out in the away fixture at the start of this season in September. He scored twice in the first 18 minutes of the game before assisting Cole Palmer in the second half in a thumping 3-0 win for Chelsea. And, well, Nicholas Jackson, two goals and an assist that time. Let's hope he can do that now. His form has dipped rather drastically, sadly. But let's hope, after a couple of assists in the last three games, maybe he can get back on the score sheet and repair, well, everyone's faith in him, but also mine, because he's been in my fantasy team for a while. Anyway, the last time Chelsea did lose a home to West Ham was the 30th of November 2019, losing 1-0 after Aaron Cresswell scored in the 48th minute. Frank Lampard was our manager that season. Enough said. On to the managers themselves. Enzo Maresca has managed against West Ham only once, which he won 3-0. And Graham Potter, on the other hand, has actually managed six times now against Chelsea. He's failed to win in all six games. He's drawn four and he has lost two. Let's hope that retains this week and he doesn't get a first win. That would be horrible. And let's hope Mr. Maresca can make it two wins from two against West Ham. It's back to you in the studio.
The Chelsea Echo presents Stat Shaggers.
Daniel.
Numbers.
Oh, he's back to the traditional numbers. But we will move swiftly on, obviously, of course, into the Chelsea Echo 11, which is also how we determine the news for the remainder of this game. But before we do that, we should probably address the elephant in the room, Dan.
Sponsored? Is it this pod is sponsored by BetBet?
Oh, mate. I wish we were sponsored by BetBet. I think we should get a big sponsor by BetBet, but we're not sponsored by BetBet. I want to talk about the guy who gave everything, just like the boys, you know, really, really, really smart guy, you know, really, really nice, incredibly boring, was not built for a top club, and got a taper fade from a really, really bang average barber. I'm talking about Graham Potter.
What do you want to talk about with him?
How do you feel about it? Like, how do you feel about him coming back? How do you think that's going to go down?
I wouldn't be surprised if he gets a negative reaction, but I don't understand why. I was never that negative about Potter in the sense that I didn't understand the visceral like dislike of Graham Potter. I just didn't get it. Because I think also in reflection of what's happened since, and you know, listen, the first half of this podcast was talking about this, that I genuinely don't think any coach, I mean, you would have had to work miracles in that. And I'm not saying that Potter, I think I do have sympathy with you that the environment was too big for him. I think the pressure was too big for him. I think you can even see in his demeanour now with press conferences for West Ham, he has slightly changed. I think there was a lot of learning quickly in that job, and it's probably done his personality some good in that you can't act a certain way at a club like Chelsea with the media scrutiny and the way every single quote you give is nailed down and isolated and sometimes unfairly taken out of context, but is so much more scrutinized than at any other club he went to before. But I have a lot of time for Graham Potter. I think he is a smart football mind. I remember reading about Graham Potter. I don't know if I've told this story on a podcast before, but I remember during the pandemic reading a lot of football books, and I read a book called The Edge that was interviewing people in football. Funny enough, one of them was Christoph Lodichon was one of the people interviewed on this book. The interesting thing about it, there were two chapters that I loved in the book. And remember, I'm reading this in the summer of 2020, so it's Project Restart time. The first chapter is about an interview with Thomas Tuchel when he was at Borussia Dortmund, speaking about Ousmane Dembele. And the other one was about Graham Potter's time at Östersunds and all the interesting things that he did at this small club in his small town and kind of the community they built, and just a really interesting football mind. Of course, I didn't know at the time that I was reading about the next two Chelsea managers. But from there, I was just fascinated by Potter as a character, and I like his honesty. I like how he isn't someone that just bows down and wants to throw out a load of neat catchphrases because maybe it'll get him more time or get him more praise in the media. I think that he was just given a really, really bad hand at Chelsea that I don't think many other Chelsea coaches would have survived in that environment. I just don't like it because everything behind the scenes was a mess. And whether he ever reaches the level of a club like Chelsea, maybe not. Maybe he is more of, at his best, maybe he is more of an Unai Emery in the sense that he is someone that could achieve things at a certain level of club. But we see this all the time, right? Coaches just seem to fit better at a certain level of expectation compared to others. And that's okay. That doesn't mean that they're a failure. That doesn't mean, like, I've never bought into, as much as I love Jose Mourinho, I remember once having a conversation with someone online that was basically that if you don't win anything in your, if you don't win silverware, you basically, your football coaching career doesn't matter. Like, everything you do doesn't matter, which is just so stupid. It's just, it's one of the most nonsensical takes I've ever heard in my life, because there are so many football clubs out there that don't win anything. That doesn't mean what they do is irrelevant because they don't win a Premier League title at the end of it. So I think that Potter, I'd be fascinated in a multiverse situation to see how Potter would handle Chelsea in a different time. But I wouldn't be surprised if he gets booed, but I don't think he should get booed. I don't know what he did. He never disrespected the fans. He never told the fans to go F themselves in all the interviews since. I think he's been very humble about his own failings and very honest and open. And I'm a little bit concerned he's picked the wrong club again. I have to say, I think West Ham is a complete mess. I don't know why he's gone into West Ham. But I don't have the rage and kind of this contempt for Potter that I think some do. But that's other people's point of view.
I have a certain level of contempt for Graham Potter. And I think it partially might be founded in the fact that he was a man who came in straight after Thomas Tuchel. Having said that, when he came through the door, I was very excited because I really liked what Graham Potter was doing at Brighton. And I was always saying, I'm really interested to see how he makes this step up. And he came in, obviously, at a very similar time to his best friend, Paul Winstanley. And I think you can see in a different role in the club, but very similar outlook, why it didn't work and why it doesn't work. And all the same reasons that we've stated about Paul Winstanley and Lawrence Stewart, I stand by with Graham Potter. When we lost 1-0 to Southampton and he comes out and goes, the boys gave everything, which was his soundbite. It was always, the lads worked hard, the lads gave everything. When we know that these are players that a season prior were challenging for Champions League football in a time when Chelsea were really, really struggling. And the season before that had won the Champions League and beaten off Real Madrid, beaten off Manchester City, three times in a row that season, may I add as well. And it showed the drop-off in quality. Granted, there was a lot of issues internally, which we've established and spoken about on many occasions, which I think is definitely what played into that, right? But his soundbite, where his way of defending the players was just, you know, treating them like children. You know, I speak to kids football players like that. You know, I spoke to my little brother when he was 10, 11, 12, like that. You know, well done, mate. Keep going. Go on, keep going. Mm. Well done. Well done. These are men's footballers that were on £100,000 a week at supposedly one of the most elite clubs in the world. And he was treating it like it was still small time. And I think that's where I got quite angry and I held a lot of contempt for him by the end, because he just wasn't willing to adapt, I felt. People talk about some of the great games he had. I think you look at that Borussia Dortmund game, I think it's a great example. I think everyone thought he was up for the sack and he kind of pulled him out of the bag. The AC Milan game away at the San Siro, I remember being there for that. I thought we played fantastically that night. But there are a lot of games where Chelsea were just so far off the pace. Mm. And quite, it wasn't completely his fault, but he didn't adapt and could not deal with that step up. and I think it hindered Chelsea's progress a lot. Granted, he's also come out since and where he's openly said, I wasn't the problem, which I completely agree with. I think a lot of fans can see now and agree with that maybe he was part of the problem, but he wasn't the problem. We can see now who it is.
Also, I think the problem is that, and it's probably still now, right, that you see maybe it's a wider societal thing or maybe it's just an insular kind of Chelsea thing, but Chelsea fans at that moment had... 2022 was a mad year in Chelsea's history. And there was a combination of upset that took all this coach that had connected so deeply with so many Chelsea fans. And I think even more so because of the way he was kind of this lone statesman during the stressful sanctions period, had gained him even more acclaim and rapport with Chelsea fans of that being taken away from them so early into the season. And then you get this coach who isn't fiery, isn't confrontational, isn't kind of fighting back, doesn't feel like he has this kind of character that's kind of leading you through. He isn't a great orator like Tuchel is, and he isn't emotional on the touchline, so it doesn't feel like you have a great representative in the dugout. And I think Chelsea fans wanted someone who was going to fight for them at that moment. And because the world had kind of turned against the club, it felt like, as a fan, you know, as an emotional fan, you'd seen the sanctions period, you'd seen a change of ownership in such a short period of time. The whole club was changing in rapid time as well in succession, and we were going through this terrible season, and it felt like internally there just wasn't that fight and desire and kind of that person, that leading beacon that people could cling on to. And I still think that's the issue right now. Like, we saw a little bit very late on with Pochettino when he became like CM Poch and he was like dropping pipe bombs in press conferences and stuff, when it was clear that he was having a go at the ownership. And Enzo Maresca now isn't really that character either. So we still are going through that period of a series of coaches who just aren't connecting emotionally with Chelsea fans in the way I think they want someone that can be a leadership figure. And Potter kind of symbolised a lot of that from the off with Clearlake. Like, he isn't that type of guy. And quite clearly did a lot of good work at Brighton. But, you know, Chelsea fans in that moment, and because of as we've already talked about, those things that can't just be overawed by tactical nous and technical beliefs or kind of progressive ideals, you do need to have a great media strategy. Unfortunately, as kind of horrible and PR that sounds, it is true. Like, as a coach, and sometimes you do need to play the game, and he unfortunately didn't. But in some ways, that's what gives me some respect about Potter, that he doesn't play the game that people want him to play, and he doesn't want to bend to... there's a part of me that likes that about him, but listen, we're not... Sometimes he did need to understand that, and I think maybe he learned a valuable lesson there.
Yeah, well, we'll have to see, and hopefully it's not a valuable lesson that'll... come up against us. I really hope not. But with all of that being said, we probably should move straight into the 11, and let's just jump straight into the deep and let's talk goalkeepers, mate, because I mean, well, let's just put in a bit of a Enzo's presser here.
Have you decided who's going to start in goal on Monday night? Will it be Rob Sanchez?
No, not yet. The decision we have, as I said, probably 2-3 days. The good thing is that any decision I take, I feel good, because every time Philip played since we start, he has done well. So Philip or Robert, we see, but any decision will be okay.
Are you at all concerned about, I think we've asked you this before, the fans' reaction to Rob Sanchez, and one, would that be a factor in your decision? And two, would you urge the fans, if he does start on Monday, to get behind the team rather than perhaps voice their disappointment? Yeah.
No, the only thing I can say is that we need the fans. We need them. The players need them. Understanding that sometimes, for different reasons, they cannot be happy with the players or with the manager in general, they cannot be happy. But for sure, we need their support, because they have to trust our direction. I'm the first one that if I see something that I don't like, I'm the first one that I don't accept that. And they can be happy in terms of the way they try to work every day, the way they try to embrace all the situation we had this season. And I'm sure that at the end we're gonna be there fighting for something.
Is there a benefit sometimes to taking a player that's struggling out of the first team for a bit, like Robert Sanchez? I mean, you've always been very forthright. He's your number one. You've always defended him publicly. But sometimes is it what a player needs when they're struggling just to take the spotlight off them, just to sit out for a bit?
Yeah, sometimes can happen. Yeah, it's not only a Robert case. I think. Is happened already this season. I think with Alisson, no, that he was okay, but he was on the bench for some games. Or, I don't know, the other day I was reading about Donnarumma, that this season with PSG he was playing always, but for some games Luis Enrique left him out, and now he's playing every game, he's doing well. So sometimes, yes, for sure, you can be a solution, but that means that this is Robert case.
So, I mean, there is a shift in the goalposts there where it's no longer Robert Sanchez is the guaranteed number one. The one thing I wasn't particularly a fan of was when he was saying, I make decisions and I know what's going to happen here. And, you know, it's me who backs the players and all this sort of stuff. Everybody very well knows that this is not all on Enzo Maresca. And a lot of this falls at the door of Ben Roberts as well, who came from Brighton, who has basically been forced in the hand to see Robert Sanchez continue to start, make the most mistakes in the Premier League, leading to goals. And the fact that Kepa Arrizabalaga was spoken about as someone who could potentially come back speaks volumes about how poor Robert Sanchez is. So are we just going to say Philip Jorgensen and rip that off like a Band-Aid? Or are we going to... We're going to have to talk about Robert Sanchez a little bit.
I don't know what more can be said about Sanchez at this point, because it does get to a stage where you no longer are kind of having a go at the individual themselves, because the incompetence was so clear such a long time ago that you have to start looking at the decision makers. And part of that, of course, is Enzo Maresca. It's not like Enzo... Well, unless Enzo Maresca is frankly being told he has to play Sanchez. I don't fully believe that, because it was also this sporting director mindset that brought us Philip Jorgensen. So I think, of course, we've got to believe that Maresca has some...
Oh yeah, I'm not saying that he's not being told he has to play him every week. I'm saying he has power in it, but I reckon the vast majority of that is going to be coming from Ben Roberts, who said he's our number one. He's a guy that's first choice.
I think it's nuanced, right? I think there's a bit of balance within there. Like, I think he knows politically from the off who was his first choice goalkeeper, and he's probably told it, right? And it was probably indicated to him. But he could have made stronger decisions. And I think that at this point, I always felt that Maresca, when he made that comment, I think we spoke about it in September when Sanchez made that error against Brighton, and Maresca came out post-game, was like, oh, you know, it's he could do that 10 more times, I'm still going to support it. And I was just like, no. Like, once Sanchez's errors start costing Chelsea in a very severe and obvious way, no coach in world football is going to just deal with that. Unless they are truly incompetent, which I don't believe Maresca is. I think that's probably really harsh on him. Or they feel absolutely no pressure. So I guess we're going to find out on Monday night where Maresca sits. Because if he goes with Robert Sanchez again, and likely the same thing happens again, then I do think it's... Listen, that doesn't mean the people above him are alleviated from scrutiny and responsibility and accountability for this. But at some point, Maresca, as a coach, should just take some responsibility here and make the obvious choice, which has been so clear for a long period of time. So there's no point spending minutes and minutes talking about Sanchez. We all know his flaws. We all know he ain't good enough. Now it gets to the point of, are you going to make the change that simply has to be made to help Chelsea get back to some sort of form this season?
Absolutely. And I think that the obvious answer to that is Philip Jorgensen. Let's give him a run of games. Let's see how he does. So he's in goal for mine and Dan's Echo 11. Left back and the back four, I'd like to think, is fairly self-explanatory, unless there's anything you want to add after the horrible showing that we saw at Man City.
I don't think I've had great games. I think Reece had quite a poor game. I thought both left backs defensively didn't look great. No one looked great coming out of the City game. performance-wise. Let's just be honest there. Like, barely anyone came out of that game looking amazing. It was a collective failure. So I do think Reece will start again. He's the captain. He's fit. I think he'll keep playing. I just would like Maresca to adapt and make us play proper fullbacks the way they're supposed to be played, and don't have this rigid belief that a fullback constantly has to invert, because I think it doesn't help us further up the pitch. I think teams have figured it out and double up and triple up against our wingers, which makes it more difficult for those wingers to get beyond them.
Mm, yeah, and that's exactly what I think. So we'll have to see with that. But I mean, the back four will go with what we had. So Kukurea and Reece as the fullbacks, Trev and Colwill as two centre-halves.
I think Colwill deserves some criticism, though. I think Colwill's performances have got worse as Chelsea's form has got worse. And I don't think he came out of last week looking great either. And to be fair, our last home game against an opponent we expected to beat was when Tosin played, right? And Tosin had quite a decent performance. So there could be a shot to bring in Tosin again. I just don't think Levi has looked that great. I've just got to be honest. I've got to be fair, right? We point out the failures of other players. I don't think on the ball he's been great. I think off the ball he kind of got bossed by Erling Haaland. I think some of his decision-making and positioning hasn't been where it should be. And as a leader, someone who's been pegged to be a leader in this back court, I just didn't see it. I haven't seen enough from Levi to suggest he's going to be that player. So he really needs to step up, in my opinion.
Yeah, I very much feel that Levi probably suits a back three. And I think this Chelsea team suits a back three, personally, with flying wing-backs. Funnily enough, we aren't going to be playing that anytime soon. So, I mean, we'll have to see how that all develops. And I do think, yeah, Levi has not been great, but our options are limited on that left-hand side. You know, Benoit Badiashile was unavailable. Tosin Adebayo didn't look particularly comfortable there. You know, as you can hear, I may have come round more to this left-back or left-footed centre-back malarkey, which we love to talk about. So, you know, we'll have to see with that. But, you know, he does need to improve, definitely, to keep his place in the team. Chelsea aren't exactly going to go dip in the market for a centre-back, are they? So, you know, remains to be seen with what happens there. Midfield, I think Moises Caicedo, Enzo Fernandez, Cole Palmer picks itself. And the front three, I mean, there were some interesting quotes about Mark Guy, actually, funnily enough, to replace Nicholas Jackson. So, let's start there. Elephant in the room. Is Jackson starting, mate? Or are you going with Mark Guy, who might add a little bit of bite to that front line?
I know people aesthetically like Guy, but he is just so raw. And I just don't understand why Nkunku just isn't being given a look in at all. I just think it's a squad malpractice, really, to not try and make Nkunku work as a player. I really do think that there's kind of no justification for it. It's not like Nkunku has been given a serious run in the first team and then he's completely failed. He's been given a couple of games, and I know his performance off the bench against City wasn't great, but I just don't get it. I just don't get when the team is faltering and you need inspiration, and I think you've got potentially a level raiser literally sitting there that you have not looked at. And you can't tell me that Maresca can't figure out a way to get him in the first team. I think it's pseudo intellectualism to try and tell me that Nkunku can't work at Chelsea because our system is so great and so flawless. People have seen through that. It ain't great. It ain't flawless. Like, it isn't helping Chelsea at the moment. I think that we are failing as a club if we look at a player, a talent like Nkunku. And of course, if Nkunku fails after being given a serious run in the first team, then we can have a different judgment on the player themselves, that they haven't taken their opportunity. But we gave Sanchez more than half a season to be our first choice. So you can't justify that you can't give Nkunku a run to be more of a first choice in this team. I don't buy it. I personally think that a serious team would try and make Nkunku work, because I think he's a natural goal scorer. I think he is someone on the ball, off the ball, I think makes runs. And particularly in games where Chelsea, I've always felt this strongly, why Nkunku is a game changer, is in tight areas. I think he can do things with the ball and his movement can be so intricate. The Bournemouth goal earlier in the season was a great example of this. Like, we haven't seen players kind of barge their way through and make something out of nothing. So whether you play Nkunku instead of Nicholas Jackson, or you do what I think a lot of us have wanted to see, is play Jackson up top, and then you play Palmer and Nkunku kind of behind him, and then whether it's Nkunku kind of on the left, or like, I passionately believe that, you know, I know a lot of people don't like him at the moment, but I still think Noni Madueke is the strongest of Chelsea's wide players. I mean, all the evidence just points to it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean Madueke off the ball has been great. He's been quite poor. But listen, there's a lot of players lining up for that reputation at the moment. So how you figure it out, I just want to see it together. And then we can make a firm judgment on it. I don't understand why we're just sleepwalking towards him, just leaving the club without ever seeing him in the first team. I just don't get it. I think in a few years, we'll be looking back and going, when we see him back at PSG or somewhere else banging in goals, why didn't we give that guy a chance?
Well, I think Enzo Maresca has been like, he's not a number nine. He's not what I want. And that has been fairly evident from the off, which is probably why I think we might see Mark Gooey ahead of him now. I agree with you that I'd love to see him in behind Jackson. I think Nicholas Jackson as a front two, a part of a front two, would be fantastic. Chelsea don't play the front two. So therein lies the first problem. But he is going to start because our options are so limited there. Unless in the time between us recording this...
Just before you say that, I don't think a new signing can come in now and be registered before Monday. I think Friday...
Can they not?
Friday lunchtime is usually the register. You have to be registered for the weekend's games. Unless, because we play on a Monday, it's different. But I think he would have had to have been registered by Friday.
Okay, so that's completely irrelevant then. So it's probably going to be Nicholas Jackson who needs to get, you know, the bite between his teeth again. I thought him comforting a Manchester City centre-back after he had a mare of a beginning was embarrassing, quite frankly.
Diego is rolling on
he'd have smelt blood. Can you imagine Diego Costa against him? Oh, that's what you want. I'd want somebody to be like, I've got you now. You're mine. That is what you need to be an elite team. Which is what Haaland did, funnily enough, against Chelsea. But yeah, him up front. Noni Madueke, by the way, I just want to touch on this. What he did with that social post, again, social posts are irrelevant to me now. Whenever a player posts something, I don't care. That really got me annoyed when he posted the picture. He's obviously scored a tap-in and talk about if you don't take risks or whatever the bloody quote was. That was embarrassing, which I wouldn't start purely just based on that, because I think a lot of Chelsea fans now are sick of him. And I'm very sick of him. To be honest, next season, based on what we're hearing about Estevao Willian, right, I'd be very interested to see if Noni Madueke even is at Chelsea by the end of next season. Because I don't think he will be. Not with that attitude. I think it stinks. But he's going to start because he hasn't got other options, really.
I understand. I have sympathy for the argument. Yeah, I think from a character point of view, I don't think he stays switched on enough. And that's undeniable. I think that he has the talent to do a lot more and he fails to do it. And that frustrates me because I see a guy there that I do think has the potential to make himself and catapult himself to an even greater height. And at times there's a bit of petulance in his game, a bit of immaturity. And this is not a guy that is still in his first few months at Chelsea. This is a guy who's played at least one full season at Chelsea. We're getting close to two full seasons. There needs to be much more from his game. Though I can only sit here and judge him with his competition currently at Chelsea and the options that Enzo Maresca has. And Pedro Neto, I know we talked about it before, you know what you're going to get from Pedro Neto, but Pedro Neto's output has been pretty terrible. Like he hasn't scored since Arsenal. That's kind of the only thing he's done all season, to be honest, of notable output. And I like Neto, but he hasn't proven himself to be better than Madueke. Sancho doesn't take enough shots. Madueke at least always looks like when he gets into those areas, he's going to take someone on. He's going to try and be progressive. He's going to try and be offensive. And that's what this team needs currently. So I understand it's not great. He isn't doing everything we want, but I'm looking at what we currently have. Like if Madueke was in an environment where we had substantially better performing players, then I think this would be a more serious conversation. At the current point where we record this podcast, that isn't the case. So he is the best of the options, which I think is why he deserves to start. And I don't quite get why he's the one that gets singled out rather than, other players, you know, someone like João Félix, for instance.
I think João Félix doesn't get singled out because he's barely played.
Well, that's the Pedro thing as well, some of the people who have really gone after Madueke are also some of Félix's biggest fans, which just makes me laugh. Like, Sancho has had some poor performances. Neto has had some pretty horrendous performances. There aren't many players in his squad who haven't, at least over the past month, had some really bad performances. I just find it weird he's the guy that gets singled out.
Do you know why I single him out? I single him out because he scores a goal, he switches off, but he thinks he's God's gift. That's how he behaves, in my eyes, when I watch him play football. And I like to be comparative with when I've coached players. And yes, I know I've done it at a lot, much lower level. But, you know, you look at certain players, you look at mentalities, and I think, look, for me, when I watch football, I have educated myself so much more in the nuances and how people react and how people think just by being part of a football club and running one in comparison to 5-6 years ago when I just lay into people for no reason, pretty much, and being very, very honest, right? We've both been around football long enough to see this as well. I lose my rag with him because he scores a goal, he thinks, that's it, I'm done, I can put my feet up, and he doesn't help the team for the rest of the game. Which is what Enzo Maresca's kicked off about constantly. Not only that, but I think the way he behaves off the pitch, again, citing that social post, it just reinforces that he thinks he's amazing. He's not. He's a very average Premier League winger, Dan. And that's me being polite. You know, and that isn't me looking at it and going, oh, you know, this is a player which I think could really grow, push on. His numbers look great, which they do, by the way, and they get better in terms of his output on the ball. Great, fantastic. Honestly, he's no better than Palace. He's no better than Crystal Palace. And I don't think he'll get any better. He is a mid-table Premier League winner. He's if I look at the Premier League table now, right? I've said Crystal Palace. I think Fulham, Palace, Brentford. I think that's where he sits. You know, he doesn't set the world alight. He's not somebody who I think is going to come into any team and really make a massive difference at a top level. He's a squad player, but he behaves like he's the best player on the pitch. And I've seen, it's just in life, seeing people like that, it just really rubs me personally. I'm speaking about my experience here. People like that rub me the wrong way because they've done nothing in their lives to prove the value that they actually are those people that think they are that good.
I don't know. I think that, I think Pochettino did a lot of great work with him last season. And I look at him towards the end of last season where a coin seems to drop with him, and that's the shame of Pochettino leaving. I think the coin dropped with a lot of players in that attacking area, and I think he did a lot of good work to make Nonny understand that, you know, there's a certain level of expectation and performance you've got to be at. But then, as we're about to wrap up this podcast, we go back to where it started, right? That lack of accountability, that lack of responsibility, that lack of pressure to get better and to be at an elite level on a consistent basis. Some people may think I'm being flippant or being unfair, and I'm trying to just consistently go back to the same point over and over again. But I do think when you have people at the top of the club that brief pretty publicly that and give the signal that there is no accountability for failing, and, you know, tangible success is not something that matters as much at the club, I just can't believe even subconsciously it doesn't filter down. And when you're giving players huge long-term contracts when they understand that it's unlikely, I know they've done the bomb squad thing, but I think the bomb squad thing mostly has failed. Like, I don't think you can say categorically it's a strategy that's worked for Chelsea, because I think for every Raheem Sterling who's still actually on Chelsea's books permanently, like, how are you going to sell that guy because his loan has failed at Chelsea? But for every Conor Gallagher, there's a Trevor Chalobah, there's a Ben Chilwell that you can't sell. So I just don't buy that strategy works. But I think subconsciously it filters down. And I'm not saying I never want to be in a position where people individually shouldn't hold themselves to higher standards, even if the environment they're in isn't great. Because I still think you should hold yourself to higher standards, even if you're frustrated by management and you think management isn't great. Like, we've probably all had experiences like that in our life where we think the people above us are incompetent. but that doesn't mean your own personal standards of work should deteriorate, because I think it reflects badly on you. However, I just can't believe that the environment that's been set at Chelsea isn't seeping down. And maybe if you want to be blunt, as you've just pointed out, people criticizing Madueke, isn't it a reflection that that guy and that kind of the character that kind of goes from playing well but then dropping those standards very quickly and thinking they've already maybe made it is a reflection of where Chelsea currently are. It's a reflection of where the ownership are. They think they've already made it, and the Clear Lake era hasn't brought us any trophies yet.
No, I agree, and that's exactly where we are. But we will wrap up there. I mean, the other winger, I think we said Jadon Sancho, probably. I think we can safely say that. So the Chelsea Echo 11, before we do wrap up, is Philip Jorgensen in goal, Cucurella, Colwill, Trevor Chalobah, Reece James, Enzo Fernandez, Moises Caicedo, Cole Palmer, Noni Madueke, Jadon Sancho, Nicholas Jackson. Doesn't fill me with confidence, if I'm being very honest. But we'll have to see. But that has been myself, that has been Dan. Obviously, you heard from Enzo Maresca and Tom as well in regards to everything to do with Chelsea versus West Ham, the Monday night football in the Premier League. Obviously, Dan and myself will be at the game. So final score with the score, we'll give you your fix straight after the final whistle. I will be giving you my thoughts from the ground as usual on there. The score will be joined by Rambles, and hopefully, we're just getting for confirmation, Simon Phillips will be joining us later on in the show as well to talk all things transfers as the deadline will be looming. Dan, am I going to expect to see you in there maybe afterwards?
We'll have to see what happens.
We'll have to see. Me and Dan will continue to bring rays of sunshine to all your lives, because that's exactly what we're doing right now. We definitely aren't crying inside of this audio-only podcast, because if you could see our faces, you could see that I'm hiding my pain behind a smile like a sad clown, because that's all I am right now. This has been the Chelsea Echo. I've been Louis.
I've been Dan.
We'll see you later. Ta-da.